The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to MerckResearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. Ryan Wirch, Wirch Capital, thank you so much for joining the CONTRARIAN podcast today. You are on the show because, like almost all of our guests, in fact, all, you have a contrarian view on markets. Now, your view is that what we are seeing here now, today, as we record this on December 15th, 2020, the Russell 2000 just hit an all-time high, if I'm not mistaken. And you think this is just the start of a major bull market. We've heard a lot of talk going back to before coronavirus about how this rally, this bull market, was kind of long in the tooth, and that it was closer to the end than the beginning. And there was a lot of speculation back then about what could end it. That all seems like a very long time ago, of course. We are now back on track, vaccines coming online, and everything just kind of may continue, but still there is some hesitation and some talk about people taking gains and kind of closing down some of this exposure, reducing some of the exposure. But anyway, why are you so bullish?
Well, thanks for the intro. And I was thinking about that. I think the opinion that the market is going to go higher, considering we've just had one of the greatest rallies off of a bear market low ever, is really contrarian, quite frankly. The reason we feel this way is we do a lot of analysis versus prior markets, and we're student of history here. So we like to go back and do a lot of comparative analysis on current markets versus prior markets. And what we found early actually in this cycle, and we wrote a blog about it back in, I believe, April, was the similar time period that we could think of from a price pattern standpoint, and some other fundamental factors too, was the 98 bear market and then subsequent rally into the 2000 tech meltdown. So what that market did is it sold off about 33% in 2.5 months. And then V-bottomed and rallied right back to new highs within about 2 months. And that's been consistent with what we've had since this current sell-off, the COVID sell-off or whatever you want to call it. We had a shorter time sell-off from February to March. It was only a little bit over a month, but similar price correction, around 35%. And I don't think anybody thought back then the market would be at new highs within a couple months and then exceed them. Mm. You know, quite frankly, I didn't think it. Mm. But we did have a roadmap, and that's what we were following. So again, peak to trough, this current sell-off lasted a little bit over a month, and we were back to highs within 2.5 months after bottoming. Mm-hmm. So the reason we think this can go on a lot higher and further than anyone can really imagine is we believe the market is in the secular bull market for various reasons. One of the dominant fundamental factors of the market over the last probably 10 years, and it's been expedited, I mean, by vast measures during this crisis, has been the monetary easing from the federal government. And then on top of that, you couple it with massive amounts of stimulus from our federal government. This just gives the underpinnings to supercharge a potential move higher, much like we had from the 98 to the ultimate 2000 blow off top. Now, you know, we're not, the timing obviously is impossible to get. But we think the secular bull market that really started in 2013 is only 7 years into it. So secular bull markets on average last 14 years. We think it could last another seven, maybe longer. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I do know, I think, that when this is over, you're going to see just such excessive behavior and participation that we really haven't seen. The breath measures and some of the statistics that we follow are characteristics of the beginning of bull markets and not the end. Doesn't mean that in the short and intermediate term, you can't have corrections. So, you know, again, on average, the market corrects up to 10% once a year, larger correction between 10 and 20% every 2.5 years, and then a bigger bear market every 5 years. We just went through a pretty significant correction, which we would deem a bear market, even mm-hmm. though it was short. Mm-hmm. So we could have years to run before a bigger significant correction takes hold.
Yeah, very interesting. Although it's a little frightening to think that people are going to get much more exuberant when you look at things like Tesla and the Wall Street Bets crowd and things like that. But, you know, also interesting comparison with 98. I've been thinking about that, and I don't think I've heard anybody else really compare these two, but I remember that well. I was just kind of cutting my teeth back then and freshly out of college. And it was the LTCM crisis in 98 and the implosion of the Asian currency crisis was the previous year. That was 97. But so you had the Russian sovereign debt defaulted. But what happened was then with the Greenspan, they came in and they kind of bailed out LTCM. But the interest rates were still pretty high from what I recall. They were like, what were they, around 5%?
I'm not sure, but they were higher. And yeah, so that can lead me into a couple different things. The similarities and the differences between now and then.
Right.
Some of the similarities that we looked at were, obviously, the 90s were a booming economy by all measures. Going into this, we had probably one of the best economies since then.
Right.
I would say the major difference between now and then was the Fed was raising rates
in
the late 90s. And now they obviously were at zero and they've been nothing but pretty much falling. Rates were actually ticking higher going into that because I think of the economic strength that we were seeing. But since then, obviously, rates have just gone to zero. And can they go negative? I don't know. They probably can because there's been examples of that around the world. Mm-hmm. But Another reason why we think this is the beginning and we're going to go higher is the amount of pent-up demand that has been created by COVID. People just haven't left their house. I know, and I'm sure you talk to people, the first thing people want to do is travel. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's been some winners and losers in this whole pandemic, and we can get into that later. But I think the one constant is that going into this, the economy was booming on all cylinders. And since the pandemic, the savings rate has gone through the roof.
Yeah.
So consumers are sitting on a pile of cash ready to go when it's all clear. I think it's going to take some time, but why has the market not sold off? And I think it's looking past the vaccine. I think it's looking past COVID. Once life gets back to normal, I think there's going to be such pent-up demand that it really could supercharge this market. Mm. And the stocks that haven't participated or have lagged could then start, and you're starting to see that now with the Russell 2000 starting to pick up steam and starting to exert some leadership. So if you get, you know, the banks, oil stocks, if you get these laggards that are actually now starting to participate, I think it's almost, it's not impossible, but I believe it's just going to drag the indices higher because you're going to get participation in all sectors of the economy.
No question. Yeah. Now, to go back to the Fed here, current Chairman Powell said he is not even thinking about raising rates.
Yeah.
At the last I heard. So he's well away from going anywhere near normalizing rates. Nevertheless, if things really start going gangbusters in 2021, if all this demand comes back and everything starts rising like crazy, at some point you're looking at inflation. And at some point the Fed is their handy, one would think, is probably going to be forced, and they probably are going to have to raise, right? And then that would then remove some of the punch bowl, right, gradually. And we've seen in the past that they tend to overreact with these things. So what do you make of that argument? Because that's something that I had a guest on here, David Hunter, and he makes the point. He has a target of 4,600 on the S&P, and he says we're going to have a much, yeah, like you, he says this is going to be a lot more, but then he says the Fed is going to overreact, and that's going to cause the whole thing to fall apart. And then he says they're going to overreact on the other side and cause another meltup, but that's another story. But yeah, so what do you think of that, about the fact that eventually the Fed's hand might be forced with by inflation or other really frothy markets?
Well, what's interesting about it now is the Fed is completely transparent these days. Mm-hmm. They weren't like that before. Do you remember Greenspan where they were trying to figure out his briefcase, what he was going to decide? The Fed has already told you what they are doing. So we know that. The Fed is going to be forced, like you said, at some point. They're going to have to. We all know that. When is the big if? Again, what happened in the 90s is the Fed raised rates. The markets kept going. I mean, Greenspan's famous exuberance speech was given, I think, in 96.
Yeah.
Markets didn't peak till almost 5 years later. Four and a half, probably. So it can go a lot further than people expect. And I do want to go back to one thing you said about the excessiveness. You know, another something contrary, and I think Tesla could go much higher because I just think it's that type of company that is probably a once in a generation type. But there's certainly been excesses in sectors of the market. I mean, new IPOs between Airbnb, DoorDash, AI. These things had massive pops on IPO days, much like the late 90s, specifically probably 99. The SPAC exuberance, where you're getting just crazy, insane valuations on some unknown companies. So there certainly is that excessiveness. But the participation, if you look at a lot of the statistics, there's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. There's still been equity outflows. Now, recently, there's been inflows, but we've had some historic outflows over the last 6 months. There's a lot of fund managers that are still positioned in cash and have cash on the sidelines. And then to top that off, you have a fixed income environment where you're getting 90 basis points on a 10-year. So you're almost forcing investors to go up the risk curve. And where's the natural place they're going to go? Equities. Mm-hmm. The majority of people that have 401ks can't go into private investments or Bitcoin or gold for that matter. So what are they're going to do? I mean, they're probably not going to be happy making a yield of 50 basis points to maybe 150. So they're going to be buying, you know, equities for yield. That's going to be the new 60-40 portfolio, which mm-hmm. is probably going to look like 100% equities.
Yeah.
So all of that money coming in, yeah, and without the pent up demand, again, I think that this has the recipe for a lot bigger move. Now, your idea of inflation is spot on, and I think you're starting to see that in a pickup of the move in gold and to an extent Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin now is probably just the new digital gold. Yeah. And gold recently hit a new high. It's sold off off the highs of the most recent move, but Bitcoin is back close to knocking on 20,000.
Yeah.
And in an inflationary environment, stocks should do well, mm-hmm. quite frankly. I don't know if I want to own bonds.
Yeah.
So I think inflation to an extent, there's going to be some asset classes that clearly outperform. And I think that does really well for a hard currency and a Bitcoin. And that's probably a whole nother discussion. I'm sure you have plenty of guys that are contrarian that know it a lot better than I do. I just look at it from a price perspective.
Yeah, I actually have a rule not to talk about Bitcoin on the. It's okay to mention it, but I yeah.
Good, because I don't know enough about it.
Me either.
No. So yeah, that's why I think equities are going to be the place to be, and you know. People are talking about the current excesses. I don't think this is anything. I was around in late 99s. Mm. That was, we're far from that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
People are still scared of the equity markets because of what just happened. I mean, I know I talk to people and even clients of mine that are saying, should we get out? Is this now the time to get out? You never hear that at the top.
Right.
At the top, everybody wants to be a buyer. Mm-hmm. You know, your grandmother who never has owned a stock wants to own stocks. We are far from that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting points. Ryan Wirtz, thanks so much. So, well, I guess this begs the question, where does one go within equities? Is there anything there that you like more than else? You touched on some of the hard currency things. Energy has kind of one of these sectors that hasn't really participated yet. It started to, so maybe that's one. I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, we specialize in growth.
Yeah.
And clearly on all metrics, growth has been outperforming value for a significant period, yeah. Whether you go 3, 5, 10 years. And it's only exacerbated in the past 6 months. You had a massive bifurcation in what led coming off of the April bottom, and growth was the clear winner by a long shot. Now, that ratio of growth to value has clearly gotten stretched to the upside. That is excessive. And there's probably going to be a reversion to mean. Doesn't mean growth won't work. It may just mean maybe value starts to pick up a little bit of the slack and work a little bit faster. We prefer to focus on growth because that's our strategy's strength. But we are not naive, and we follow the trends, and we see the current leadership over the past probably 2 weeks to a month and a half, that value has really picked up a bit in the market. And I think that goes back to fund managers and investors alike are starting to realize that there is this pent-up demand, and travel and leisure and the economy is not going to be at a standstill forever. I think we're going to have to get through this winter, and psychologically, it's probably going to take a little bit longer, but But I think people see the light at the end of the tunnel where maybe 6 months ago or 3 months ago, they didn't. So some of those beaten down sectors certainly are places that are probably going to have the greatest gains. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned oil, travel and leisure still, airlines. I mean, people are going to fly again. I don't know if it's, I had this discussion with somebody the other day. I don't think things are ever going back to the way they used to be. But that doesn't mean change is bad. I just think things are going to be done differently, and it could even be more efficient. I don't think business travel is probably ever going to go back to the extent it was prior to this, but that doesn't mean, you know, more people could be traveling for leisure than they ever have. So I think, again, there's going to be winners and losers, and that's part of my job is trying to figure out, you know, where they are and where those trends are heading to. But I certainly believe the beaten down sectors that haven't participated nearly as much as growth are probably an area to look at for sure.
Interesting. All right, Ryan Wirch, I want to take a short break and come back and ask you a little bit more about yourself and your firm. But let's first take a short break. If you are a premium subscriber, you do not get the break, so don't touch the dial. We will be right back. If you are not a premium subscriber and you want to be a premium subscriber, which you very well should, go to contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H, and sign up.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarized the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K.
All right, welcome back, second half of the show. This is where we dig in a little bit more with our guest and try to get to know him a little better. Ryan Wirch of Wirch Capital. So Ryan, tell us about yourself, how you got started investing and how you came now to start your own firm, how old the firm is. And you already mentioned that you guys focus more on growth stocks. We can talk about that later, but first about your background.
Sure. I graduated Virginia Tech, finance major. So I ended up going into working in family business, which is electrical subcontracting, which is the furthest thing from finance. You know, my dad and my brother worked there, wanted me to come work for them. Did that. I worked for a couple summers there. Quickly realized I did not like electrical subcontracting. So another one of my brothers introduced me to a couple brokers late in 99 at a small boutique broker dealer outside of DC called Nubian Company. And they were just so busy because they were trading their own accounts and they had retail and some institutional customers, but they were making so much money individually. They just needed help servicing their clients. So ultimately I nagged them long enough that they finally decided to give me a job. I got a job there late 99, got licensed, did that whole thing. The two brokers that hired me ended up leaving the firm shortly after starting their own firm where they were just managing private money, the money that basically they made the prior bull market. I ended up working for them for 6 years, more of a family office type of environment. I ended up trading a proprietary account for them, which kind of gave me the confidence to go out and start my own hedge fund, which I started in October of 2008. But even to go back a little further, the reason I got into it is when I first started to work for my bosses, I opened up an account with $500. I saved all the money I had back then. I was living in my parents' house, driving an old beat up car. Didn't have much money. And every paycheck I had, I put money into a savings account. Finally, I opened up a brokerage account. And all I do was buying what my boss has told me. I didn't know anything about the market outside of watching maybe CNBC or reading an article here or there in the Washington Post or Wall Street Journal. Very naive. And back then it was very easy and everything I bought went up. And, you know, of course, green behind the ears, I thought that I was going to be a millionaire in no time. And this was very easy. Well, the tech bubble burst very quickly. And my aspirations of becoming a instant millionaire quickly subdued. So I essentially lost basically half of my account in one day because I was in one position. It was Nortel Networks. They released earnings and the stock opened up. I think it was down 40-some percent. Luckily, I didn't have a whole lot of money back then, but it was a really good learning and experience for me. And at that point, I realized that I had to get educated and I have to figure this out on my own. I can't rely on other people for advice. And that basically set me off on this whole journey that I'm still on. Mm-hmm. Every day is really a learning experience. But that experience led me to realize I hated massive losses. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create a strategy that I could avoid massive drawdowns. My bosses were very smart, very good investors, but they had the ability to sit through massive drawdowns. They specialized in small cap stocks, micro cap stocks that were liquid. Sometimes you had to sit in them because you couldn't get out of them for liquidity reasons. I realized that that wasn't for me. And I truly believe everybody has to trade their own personality. And there's really a million ways to skin a cat in this game. There's really no two traders alike. We all trade similar styles, but everyone at their core probably has their own personality in their strategy. And for me, that was avoiding another catastrophic loss. And that's when I started my strategy. That was the objective and goal of it. And now, you know, started the fund in the teeth of the financial crisis in 08. We're still around 13 years later. Since then, we've had five disruptions in the market, whether you want to call them bear markets, corrections, whatever they are. The financial crisis obviously was a massive one. The flash crash in May of 2010, the European debt crisis of 11, the tantrum of 18, and the COVID pandemic most recently. Each of them, market came down around 20, in some cases 50% corrections. And I've been able to avoid all of those massive down moves. And that's, again, what my strategy is set to do. Mm. So that's a little bit of kind of history and how I got into this. But I will say, you know, I'm still fairly young in the investing world, but I've been doing this in the business for a little over 20 years. And really every day is a learning experience. Mm. I think that's the beauty of the market. It's really the wild, wild west. It's the last frontier. Every day is different. Mm-hmm. And just when you think you know everything, the market has a really funny way of humbling you and showing mm-hmm. something you never saw. And, mm-hmm. and like we had talked previously, the next crisis is going to be something we have no idea, much like COVID. Nobody saw that coming.
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be underlying reasons why we have a crisis. And a lot of it's probably going to have to do with our debt and the excessive easing. But what triggers that crisis will probably be something that's completely new mm-hmm. and different. Yeah. And that's my strategy isn't predicated on forecasting that. It's predicated on reacting to certain things. And we're quick to get in or quick to get out. And by doing that, we allow ourselves not to lose a lot of our investing and emotional capital. Mm. And that's how we're able to, you know, outperform on the downside for sure.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And you've certainly had a good year for your fund. Yeah. Talk to us about that. How you traded around this year.
Sure. Well, it first started with missing the February to March correction. I mean, people's portfolios were down 20 to 30, 40% in some cases in a month.
Yeah.
We didn't lose a penny. In fact, we were at the bottom of the market in in March, we were up for the year by single digits, mid single digits, which, you know, my investors were just tickled pink when the majority of their other portfolios were, like I said, down anywhere from 20 to 40%. And, you know, our motto is win by not losing. So, you know, we don't have to make as much on the upside if we don't lose on the downside. And we just wait for those opportunities to present themselves. And this year, better than any other year, we just had a perfect opportunity by getting back into the market at a pretty reasonable time. And because we specialize in growth, and growth has been the biggest beneficiary, I think, of this whole move, we were really able to capitalize and outperform drastically. And it's been a banner year for sure.
What caused you to get out, though, before? Because like you said, nobody's really saw COVID coming.
So it's funny. We talk about how the market is now back at highs and there's some excessive behavior. We had some excessiveness show up in some of our statistics back in January and February. Remember, last year was actually a really good year.
Yeah.
And from the 2018 bottom, the market really had a mm-hmm. huge rally from the fourth quarter of 18 to the first quarter of 2020. And some of those excessiveness started showing up in our internal indicators that we run. We have a proprietary signal that we run on the general market. And again, I had no way of forecasting what was coming to happen, but we positioned the portfolio in the event that something did happen. We bought a tremendous amount of protection via puts, and we actually started selling our long positions in late February, raising our cash balances. And once price broke, we got out instantly. Our puts kicked in, and it really protected us beautifully. And we really sat out the market in cash for probably about 2 months. We'll never buy the bottom. We'll never sell the top. We waited for some confirmation behavior coming off of the bottom in April. We probably didn't position their portfolio on the long side heavily until May. Mm-hmm. And then the rest is really history.
Mm. Cool. I'm curious what some of those signals were that you picked up on that caused you to, was it just taking profits off or yeah?
Sure. Some of it was definitely that, where we had excessive moves in individual positions we owned. You know, our long book is made up of individual growth stocks. Our short book is typically made up of indices and sector bets.
Right.
So again, we follow probably 25 internal indicators that we follow that. These are widely known indicators. They're you know, made up of breadth and sediment. And we definitely started seeing a significant excessive moves in a lot of them that were showing up when we talk about prior time periods. We went back and looked the last time these started flashing, and it was clearly a warning sign. So it kind of put up our cautionary radar that something could happen. We never know what's going to happen. We don't predict, we react. And it just so happened, our timing was really impeccable. Hmm.
That's amazing. Wow. But even there, I mean, there's always, it seems there's always a time in the market when there's like these signals and, you know, moving averages and stuff that various signs of certain things that, so for you to be able to act on them is still pretty compelling. And the fact that you had that and as a contrarian, of course, the hardest thing to do is when everyone else is buying to sell,
sure.
Or at least to move to cash, right?
Sure.
So, yeah.
Sure. I mean, at any given time in the market, you can find two opposing views. You can find someone that has a bullish view and someone has a bearish view, and they're looking at the exact same data.
That's right.
It's true.
Yeah.
And again, I never know who is right or what is right. All I know is that we stay disciplined to our strategy through thick or thin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always right, but it has served us well in the 13 years that I've run my fund. And the main objective of that is to really miss the down moves. And we've done that.
Mm.
So I would say, again, I'm not a fortune teller. I don't have a crystal ball. I do have extreme discipline, and I'm willing to make decisions based on that.
And
doesn't mean that I'm a super rigid. I think you always have to adapt.
Yeah.
But we stay true to our core principles. And I think that's the biggest thing. I think most people that fail in this business become undisciplined. Or they start chasing the latest returns. I've certainly gone through periods of underperformance and it feels awful. There's nothing worse than a drawdown and you start to question everything. And it forces you to really dig down deep. And the one thing that's been a constant is my persistent work ethic and motivation, and couple that with just an extreme discipline. I think that's what's served me well and my partners well, quite frankly.
Very cool. Now, okay, so you still like growth now, even into 2021. Are there any particular sectors of growth that you can tell us about that you're maybe looking about a little more closely?
Sure. And I know saying I like growth isn't extremely contrarian.
Well, no, but it is now because we've rotated out a bit. So
I agree. I think because of the outperformance, mm-hmm. people are expecting some other area to perform maybe the next cycle. Mm. I think growth is going to be the place to be because I think technology is going to I think we're in this technological revolution that businesses are becoming so efficient by using technology that it's here to stay. And I think COVID has expedited that by probably 5 years. Mm. If you go and read various different conference calls from different companies, you can even see it in the CEO's comments, how they've said, we've done stuff in the last 3 months that we didn't think we were gonna do for the last 5 years. Mm. And that's because companies were forced to adapt to this new normal. And the easiest way for them to adapt was to embrace technology. So whether it's cloud computing or I think probably the biggest beneficiary of COVID, and I don't think this is going anywhere, is computer security, cloud security specifically. And if you look at the US Treasury just got hacked the other day, clearly there's a need for it. One other area I think is, again, probably going to wildly outperform, and it's done well the last handful of years, is biotech. I think we're in another age of innovation that is there's going to be so much breakthroughs, whether it's cancer. I mean, the vaccine is fascinating and how quickly we're able to do that. And I think these biotechs and these companies are so well capitalized now that the next 10 years, I think the sky's the limit of what's going to be discovered and how healthcare is going to be probably revolutionized through advancements in science. So I think those areas specifically, and you couple that probably with a hybrid of the two, which would probably be like a telemedicine, I think these are going to be the areas that I believe are going to outperform, even though they have in the last 10 years. They may not in the last 3 months, but I think if you take a longer term time horizon, these are the areas that I want to be invested in. And these are the areas that I'm going to focus in most likely.
Cool. You didn't mention autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars or anything like that.
No, but everything's going to electrification. I think everything's going to autonomous, whether it's cars or any other industry. I think robots are going to be a bigger part of our life for this foreseeable future, whether it's drone technology or autonomous vehicles. I mean, I think that addressable market is so big that I clearly believe we're going the way. I don't think it's going to happen as fast as some of people that are bullish believe. I think it's probably going to be a little bit longer, but I do believe the world we know it probably 10 years from now is going to look drastically different than it is now. I mean, if you think about what happened 10 years ago, I mean, I think Facebook was just invented. Can you imagine? I have 4 kids. They don't know a world without Instagram or Snapchat. I mean, these companies were just invented. Yeah. Technology has gotten so much faster. And the rate of adoption has gotten so much faster that I think, again, what our universe looks like 10 years from now is going to be drastically different than now. There's going to be a whole section of new innovators that we don't even know about.
Yeah. Very cool. Ryan Wirch. Okay. In closing, maybe tell us where we can find out more about you and your firm. I know you have a Twitter where you're not very active. is it WorchCapital.com?
WorchCapital.com is Twitter handle. Website, www.WorchCapital.com. I write a blog, probably active there maybe once a month, has a little bit more in-depth of my market views, a little bit more macro top-down. Other than that, I've done some other podcasts, a simple Google search, and you'll find some info on myself and my firm.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us again. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you all again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.